Hey, welcome to the River Talk Podcast, a river-focused podcast hosted by Zach Collier, Priscilla Macy, and me, Eric Weiseth. This week, Priscilla's out doing Priscilla stuff, so we have Mr. Priscilla, Jacob Cruiser himself.
Hey.
Also, world, you know, Northwest famous exploratory boater who has got one of the more popular, or had one of the more popular blogs out there on the rivers, probably never do. And we have a guest, Lee Baker, to help us talk about something specific, and we'll get into that in a minute. But first, we always like to start with news of the week. So, Zach, what do you got for us?
I have something I want to talk about. It's not news. Well, it's kind of news. It's just boating and COVID. And I've been doing a little bit of boating off and on over the past few weeks. I actually stopped boating a month ago for a while because I was kind of frustrated by how paddlers were handling COVID on shuttles and just boating in general. And I just kind of like said, I need to take a break. And I got back and I boated again the other day and just want to share some thoughts I have about how we can do this responsibly. And I feel like we're actually super lucky that rivers and public lands are open, that, you know, if our government, whether it's state government or local governments, saw some of the things happening, they might remove boating like they did in the spring. And so I just want to say, I'm super appreciative we can still boat, but I think we need to take it on ourselves as citizens to be responsible so it's not taken away. I'm a big personal responsibility person. Like, I don't like it when the government takes something away. I would rather we just did the correct behavior and we're responsible out there. So I just want to share some things I think are really important. Would love to get you guys' feedback because I could be wrong. I could just be, you know, oversensitive to this. The first thing is there's no hitchhiking anymore. Like people should not expect to hitchhike shuttles. I got super frustrated the other day when a guy walked up to us and wanted to hitchhike. It just seems it's the second time I've been asked in the COVID era. And I just don't think that should be a thing anymore because we don't know you. We've brought enough cars to socially distance in the cars. We don't, you know, what I'm trying to do is minimize the number of people per car. So when you hitchhike, you're changing our numbers. So I'm going to say no hitchhiking. Do you guys disagree with me? Do you feel like it's okay to be hippies right now?
I want to go back real quick to the comment you made about social distancing in cars. Mm-hmm. Like, I get and I appreciate that you're trying to be more responsible than less responsible, but we should all accept that at no point are you actually social distancing in cars. You're doing better than packing them shoulder to shoulder and you're wearing masks and everything else. But that's still, at the end of the day, is like, unless you're driving with your windows down or a, you know,
that's where I'm getting
school forerunner with the top off. Like, you know, that is the most hazardous environment of your entire day. So
yeah,
I'm with
sure,
you on the
sure.
Like hitchhiking adds an element to that that is above and beyond versus people who either you're choosing to be in a small space with them, knowing that they're irresponsible in the rest of their life, or you're choosing to be in a small space with them, hoping that they're responsible in the rest of their life. But, you know, and hitchhiking is a bigger outlier. But that's, I don't think we should use language like social distancing in cars because we should all acknowledge that that's not a reality.
I think there's things you can do, though. And that's the other thing I want to talk about. First, yes. I want to say hitchhiking is not cool. I think there's things we can do. And these are the rules I'm following and just want to share. One person per window. So if your car has four windows, that's four people. So if I have four windows and I have a hitchhiker, I have a fifth that breaks the rule. And everybody wears masks and all the windows are down. That seems like, to me, the minimum that we should be doing. And so it's not, you're not technically socially distanced because you're not 6 feet away from everybody. But with the window open, that creates airflow and everybody should wear a mask. And I've been in a few shuttles lately where I forgot my mask. I think I talked about this. And I just put my head out the window. That's my fault. Or where everybody else didn't bring a mask and I had to put my head out the window again because they were a family unit. Because they're like, oh, we're a family unit. We don't have to wear masks. I'm like, oh, cool. I guess I'm left out. And so I feel like one of the issues I see is boaters just forget their masks or they have them on the put in, but don't have them at the takeout. And so what I'm going to suggest is that everybody buys a box of like disposable masks. It's $15. Every car, every shuttle car, every boater car should just have a box of disposable masks in there. And that way when you get to take out, you're like, oh, my masks are put in. You just have them ready to go. So I'm going to express my thoughts about paddling and COVID. One, hitchhiking is not cool. two in the cars, one person per window, windows down, everybody with masks. And three, every paddler should have a box of disposable masks. Does that seem reasonable to you guys? Am I overbearing here or am I not responsible enough?
That feels about right to me. I mean, I think that's, I like we've talked about before, I throw a mask or two. I just keep a couple masks like in my sort of lap bag, like my little watershed bag, so that when I get to the end, I have a mask. But, you know, I also decided a while ago just to keep a box of disposable masks in my car because I inevitably leave my house and forget to take one with me. And so I just got a resource there so I can always have one available. So I think that makes all of those things sound like the right moves.
I just want to give my thoughts and my rules based on what I've been seeing, because I have not seen those things happening. And I feel like we need to be responsible on our own so the government doesn't come down and say, oh, no more paddling. You guys aren't doing this well.
Well, I think that's the thing, but I think there's also the piece of like, yes, we should be afraid, especially in Oregon where there's a tendency for a little bit more heavy-handed action. Good or bad, not
in Washington
on that at all. But yeah, Washington too. Like I'm not saying those are bad things. I'm just saying those are realities where like the concern about being shut down is totally legitimate. You know, we had rivers shut down last spring and that's totally possible. It could happen again. The other piece I would add is that, you know, I think there's a tendency, especially on, you know, male, like 40 and under males, that maybe we don't developmentally have a great connection to consequence sometimes. And, you know, if you're a boater, you're probably an athlete. You value your capacity. You got to do these things. I know people in their 30s who have ended up in the ICU with this and have long-term consequences. Like you don't want it. I get there's a lot of, you know, there is a lot of press out there about how it's not a big deal for most people. And maybe you're one of those people, but there's also a chance you're not. And the consequences could be like that you don't get to boat for a long, long time because of that. So, you know, take it seriously for your own health and well-being.
I don't want it. So when I went boating a month ago and it was just pandemonium and I'm like, I'm out. I don't want to paddle anymore. And I've taken a break and gotten back into it, but I'm very selective about what I'm willing to do because I don't want to get shoved in a car with the windows down for 20 minutes with people I don't know. It's not safe. I fear for my safety, but it's also not fair to my wife for me to come back and potentially get her sick because we couldn't bring an extra car, right? Or it's going to take more vehicles and it's going to be worse for the environment because we're driving more vehicles. And there's going to be the extra bag of masks or box of masks, but I think it's responsible right now. So that's my rant. That's all I want to talk about. That's my news of the week.
I think that I think there's one piece I would add there though, that was like a really good point about your spouse. You know, for me, I feel like sometimes, you know, it's sort of the, like, why are you being so hyper cautious? And a big part of it for me is the people that I'm connected to. And not wanting my kids to stay home from school for 2 weeks because, you know, I got it and then they were exposed to me. And so now they have to stay away from their friends and school and all these other activities, you know, or my wife can't do things like all that stuff.
Yeah.
There's consequences for those around me if I get sick. And so that's the other piece of it.
Yep.
Just like the social pieces. That, and as my friends say around here now, like if you get, there's definitely like a social stigma of, you know, like you failed to be a good person if you ended up getting this, like you weren't being responsible or something. There's like a social pressure now to not be that person.
That's interesting.
Yeah. To what Eric was saying a little bit earlier about it, long-term consequences. I have talked to a couple people who got it kind of early on in the spring, and they say they're still like, their lungs are affected and that when they go to get something out of the refrigerator, they can feel that their lungs are just not the same anymore. And that certainly affects kayaking.
Yeah. All of us that are, I mean, you know, all of us that kayak probably also bike and ski, and it really is hard on our life. And it's not that hard to be responsible, right? What I'm suggesting here isn't that hard to do. And we could go further. We could say two people per car if we had to, but yeah.
Cool. Well, should we move on to the main topic of the week? Zach, do you want to go ahead and introduce our guest and what we're going to be talking about?
Sure. Our guest is Lee Baker. I don't know Lee very well. I would love to have a paragraph to talk about you. Maybe Lee, if you want to introduce yourself and then just take it over. I honestly don't know you that well. I just like you.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I like you too. I was sitting in Hood River one time next to Nicole, and I had corresponded with you about boating. This is like 4 years ago. Uh-huh. And you texted Nicole and said, some guy named Lee texted me to boat. And she's like, he's sitting right next to me right now. We're going to float the wind or something. So that's me. Hey, man. Yeah, Lee Baker. I'm from Eugene. So I hook up with a lot of folks down here and boat. And I've lived here for about 25 years now. And, you know, just about me, I'm a school counselor. And that has allowed me to do what I love just from a human side of things, but also to get to have a lot of time to share just in the whitewater of a family. And we get out a lot. And so I was a raft guide in college. So starting in like 1998 and did that for a while and have just continued to want to be around water, whitewater. In the last 3 years or so, I decided I'm not going to be young forever. So I need to probably start kayaking one of these days. And so I've been putting a lot of time and energy into that. And I think the thing when we talk today about heuristics and heuristic traps, you know, we're following up. I liked Dustin's episode. He came on. If you can go back and listen, I'm not going to recover everything he taught, but he did a nice job of sharing about heuristic traps and whitewater. And for me, here, let's start with this. I'm going to ask you guys, why are you river people? So like a sentence on each of you share, why are you a river person? What is it?
That's tough to answer on short notice in one sentence. I like exploring. So, you know, before I was a river person, I was a backpacker. And then I was like, oh, you can float too and do this. So it's, for me, it's about seeing new places.
I think I would nowadays probably have a lot of my answer would be sort of the same as Zach's, the exploration. It's a mechanism for exploring, seeing new places, taking on kind of new experiences, you know, problem solving, that kind of thing. I think a younger me would have said that, you know, it's about conquering a challenge, you know, the being above a rapid and deciding to go for it and then out the bottom, you know, taking like committing to something, having no way out and sort of taking on what comes and coming out the bottom. Like, that probably would have been a more important part, and having something to just develop, a challenge to have a goal and then achieve a goal without needing a team.
Awesome.
Yeah. I'd certainly agree with both Jack and Eric there. I guess an add-on would be, I feel like we live in a world with where a lot of what you do is dictated by other people, and in whitewater, you can kind of make your own rules. There aren't laws in kayaking, just guidelines. So it's cool to do something where you can kind of pick your own path. And I think that bodes or ties into the exploratory stuff that you guys were talking about.
There you go. Thanks, Jacob. I threw you that pitch right down the middle. Thank you. Sets things up well. So yeah, I just got to thinking about why heuristic traps, why is this so relative to whitewater? And where my brain goes is when I think about, I have all the things that you guys have shared for my own self. And one of them is I feel the need to connect to the energy of the earth, you know, whether it's, you know, creator or, you know, just the amazing power that happens right there on a river. And that doesn't matter if it's class one or if it's class five. So like, I need to be a part of that. And in doing so, I'm making the choice to go out into it. And kind of like, I think it was like Eric said, maybe you're, or maybe Jacob, you go out into it on purpose and you leave behind your comfort and your thinking and the things that you do on a day. At least I have to in my job, so I don't get to live out there all the time. And so why heuristic traps becomes super relative to me is as I have to, in a way, open up another side of my brain, because otherwise I'll fall right into these same patterns of thinking. And just to, in case you haven't heard that episode or don't know what heuristic thinking is, it is either a rule of thumb or a shortcut or a thing that happens in your subconscious connected to your conscious brain that just allows you to make choices very easily. It's why as humans we have evolved as we have, and we get smarter as, you know, the ages go on. It's part of the reason for that. And it works for us about 99.9% of the time until it doesn't. And when it doesn't, it can unfold really quickly. So, and those are the traps that we'll talk about right now. So that's really just a very basic, you can research heuristics in business or, you know, any outdoor thinking or, so it's a pretty, in my mind, it's a pretty fascinating thing just to think about how we conceive what we understand. So, for me, when I look at a river, there is a part of, I want to go out and get out of my comfort and get into a risk zone at some level. And honestly, like even class two rivers are risky in some ways. They are dangerous too, just like a class four river is. So, I'll throw out this, analogy. I use it in swiftwater classes, but a river is basically, if you jump on a river, you are riding a moving avalanche, and which is so fitting because heuristic traps came out of backcountry skiing. Yet in backcountry skiing, you do everything to prevent getting on this avalanche. But in river, you walk right in and you jump on the avalanche. And a couple of the funny, well, just side note, a couple of funny differences. You would never go backcountry skiing and show up, you know, at Highway 22, Jackson Wool, you know, and jump in and say, hey, what are you guys doing? Let's go. Everybody who goes up into that mountain would say, what do you have for gear? What's your training? What's your expertise? Do you know the slope angle? Do you know, you know, they would, you're not going to go jump in with a crew, but we do it all the time kayaking. We ask very little questions a lot of times. Some groups do, and some groups have great protocols for that, but we jump on moving avalanche without actually really doing a lot of work sometimes that I think puts us at risk for some bad stuff to happen. So that's kind of where I'm coming from is moving into this choice. Couple of the things that have driven me to think about this more in, and I'm not here to share about this at all, but in 2014, I was involved in a rafting trip that had a fatality, and I had been a rafter for maybe 5 years at that point. And I had some training and some experience, but what I did not have at that time, in my life were a lot of the pro social skills and my own understanding of weaknesses, strengths, and how that plays out in a group setting, how that plays out in my own mind and feeling. And so all I can say when I got done with that event in my life was a lot of things went wrong and I didn't really know why. It was actually, a lot of it was, some was obvious, but some was a mystery on how these things compounded on themselves. And actually what happened was there were at least seven different heuristic traps that the whole group fell into on that day when someone died. And so, it, for me, it's always been, now I can look at it really objectively without, you know, I guess without a lot more pain than I used to have, but it's something that I wanted to know a lot more about it because I want to prevent that from happening everywhere I go. And if I can teach people to do that, that's what I want to be part of. So,
yeah, I think that you're sort of like, when I think of heuristic traps, I always come from sort of that avalanche awareness backup and how much that is a conversation in sort of the backcountry skiing avalanche world. And for you to equate, you know, hopping on a river is to like walking into the avalanche, I find that really fascinating, super interesting analogy. So I look forward to kind of hearing more of where you're going.
Yeah, man. You know, one of the big differences is, you know, you go out, obviously, like you're avoiding the avalanche in backcountry skiing. But one significant difference that I find, as Jacob mentioned this already, is that when we go onto the water, There are many ways to do it. There are many levels to do a run, many places to put in and take out, many ways to run a rapid, many ways to set up safety. And then wait till you get into rescues. Geez, there's like, you could have 12 different ways to pull a boat off of a rock, right? When you get into technical rescue systems. So there are many, many, many ways. And so this is where I feel like the heuristics, the traps especially, change a little bit, because there's a lot of opportunity to make poor choices and to make great choices too.
So just for, you know, maybe we've gotten a little far into this, but for those who are newer to this concept, maybe it'd be helpful if we just gave a quick overview of how we would define heuristic traps and maybe what some of the main ones are, especially in the river world.
Yeah, let's, so Eric, yeah, you don't know this, but what I thought I'd do is go through these, and I want to have you guys help me out with some examples on these in a minute. I'll go through all, and I pulled one. Backcountry skiing had six of them. I pulled one called the availability heuristic, and this has to do with how many options there are. And an availability heuristic is essentially what comes to your mind first. And if you're a feeler personality, you might trust that real fast. If you're a competitive person, you might want to be the first one to have the best idea. If you're a doer, you might jump in and just do it because it came into your brain. And so this availability heuristic is one that it wasn't there in backcountry. And again, I think because the rules are so fixed in backcountry and they're not in whitewater. So I don't know if you guys get a kick out of this or not. So I ended up doing this wonderful thing called anagram. I crafted these out. The way I remember it is safe sack. And I'll go through them in a minute. And that'll probably be the order I go through them.
It's an anagram. Wait, what's an anagram. Anagram.
Yeah, where the
and it's, doesn't that mean it's spelled forwards and backwards the same?
Oh, maybe it's anagram.
No, I think you're thinking acronym. Of like an acronym. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, I had to use the anagram with the letters to make the word. So safe sack, S-A-C-K, S-A-C is the one I use. And that would go, I'll go through this in a minute, but social proof, acceptance, familiarity, expert halo, that's safe. Sack would be scarcity of resource, availability, and commitment. Now, if you're someone who really likes a sticky acronym, then you're going to probably want to use ass face because that also works for this set of letters. And as Jacob pointed out, you don't want to be an ass face and fall into a heuristic trap.
I'm taking notes on this stuff right now, just so you know. I'm going to put it in the blog because I'm, speaking of Dustin, Dustin likes acronyms a lot. So you're making Dustin's day right now.
Awesome, man. Well, I'll send you a couple slides that have this all listed out too on a presentation that I have going. So
ass face, really? That works.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Safe sack. Oh, there's no K. Got it. Okay, I'm with you. Safe
sack. All right. Where was I? So but two things I want to cover, and you guys gotta help me out here. One is personality traits, we'll do that in a minute. But another one is I want to be sure listeners just, because I think the more we hear these things, the more we just wake up to them. But what are the things that you guys have seen? Jacob, jump in on this one, that are what I call contributing factors. They are the things if someone is doing or not doing that it sets you up to make a poor choice later. So fall into potentially a heuristic trap.
Sure. When people don't treat every situation as a unique situation, so they've got a preconceived notion of how something should be dealt with.
Yep, availability right there, exactly. Yeah.
I could do an example of that, or we stick into the
for sure. Let's hear it here.
Okay, so one that kind of guided a lot of my thinking in kayaking is, when I was younger, we were running something. It was the Table Rock Fork of the Malala. It's got a short gorge near the end of it. There's only a few rapids in there. The last one is kind of a sticky hole, but it's not particularly intimidating. But I had read about this hole, and so on the way up there, I decided, okay, I'm going to scout this rapid. And it's roadside, so I was going to do it on the way up. And as we were going up, I mentioned that, and the group said, we'll check it out when we get to the river. And I said, okay, sure. That's fine. So then we get down there and get right above the rapid. And I'm sitting there with one other guy and I say, okay, should I hop out here and check it out? And he says, oh, no, wait till everybody gets down there. And then everybody gets down there. And then we sort of just, I say one more time, like, oh, should we scout it now? And he goes, no, you know what? It's really straightforward. Just go ahead. And that didn't really sit with how I voted, but in my mind, I went, you know what? Everything always works out in kayaking. I've never, like, this has always worked out whenever I've done this. So I'll follow him. And it did not work out well. Definitely got stuck in the hole, worked in there. And then, like, fortunately there was like this pothole. And so I'm like upside down in my boat, holding onto this pothole. and just decide I've got this opportunity to get out. So I get out, hop into this pothole, and then my other buddy comes down, gets stuck in the same hole, and I end up having to pull him into the pothole, and then our boats eventually flush right under the wall on River Right, and they were under there for 15 minutes. So had that pothole not been there, we would have also been under that wall for 15 minutes. So the trap there was that in my mind, I kind of knew I should have scouted, but I said in my head, you know what, it always works out. I'll just make it happen. And you can't just make it happen all the time. So that would be an example of falling into a heuristic trap.
Yeah, super good example. If you if you've ever had a chance to boat with Jacob, it's like it's watching a thing of beauty. It's a person who can, with all within about 5 seconds, find an eddy, be out of his boat, jump up on a rock, grab his throw bag, give you a signal on where to go, and you go. It looks like a superhero kind of running around on the bank of a river. It's pretty neat.
Thanks.
What kind of, and the acronym, which heuristic trap is that?
Well, I jumped in. It could be others. I wasn't there. There could have been other factors going on. But that to me sounded like availability thinking. His first thought was this always works out. That's the one that came to his brain. In all these traps, one thing that I do, and it's because I'm a thinker, or excuse me, because I'm a feeler and a doer, I always say, Lee, stop and think. I had to learn that. I'm sure I've learned it the hard way, but when I was young, it was stop and think. If you're a thinker personality, you got a mate as a boater. You're going to sit there and look it over and take your time and pull all the critical information needed. All the, you know, scouting is a huge part of that when the rapids get more difficult, right? But a thinker is someone who, I'm attracted to thinkers. My best friend is a thinker all the way. I like being around thinkers. They're the kind of people you want to boat with, or if they're not, if that's not their primary strength, you want them to exercise that personality on the river constantly. That has to be. But the people who are doers, like my natural instinct is go toward danger, jump in, you know, not just have the gut feeling. That's dangerous. For folks, and they don't check that as a rule with heuristic traps.
I mean, think about this one a lot because I get caught in this where it's good to think about things, but I'm also super worried about time. And so like a lot of times I'm with a group and they're thinking too much. And I'm like, oh guys, I don't think you realize we have to get off the river today. Like we have to make so many miles. So I think there's a fine line between thinking and actually going, you know, the 20, 30 minute scouts can be problematic if there's more than 10 of them.
Great right? point.
Or if there's more than two of them even. So I think that's a tough one for me. I get caught up. I sometimes push because I'm looking at my watch a lot.
Yeah. Well, let me throw these out because we're going to get deeper into the traps real quick here. But let me throw out a couple and then you'll piggyback off this because you know where I'm coming. These are not the actual traps themselves, but things like deteriorating weather, fatigue, alcohol, drug use. Here's a huge one, improper PPE, improper gear, or using the gear the wrong way, right? Those are a couple examples. Jump in, see if you guys can get some more.
Are those traps?
Those are not traps. Those are contributing factors. They pull okay. right into a trap, but yeah.
You said PPE, but I think a lot about improper clothing.
Yeah, yeah.
In the late starts, I just mentioned earlier, like, got to stop and get a latte and a burrito. And, oh, I forgot so-and-so. And, you know, somebody has to go back and get a spray skirt. I think that contributes to this stuff a lot.
Yeah. Time is one of the top three, four for sure.
Did you already say familiarity?
That's actually a trap itself.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Higher, lower than expected water levels.
Yes, for sure.
For all of the things you're talking about.
Yep. And I kind of included that in like dynamic factors of a river. That also includes a piece of wood when you least expect it too, because rivers change all the time, every day. Okay, here's kind of a fun one. Here's kind of a fun one is, sorry, Zach, go ahead.
I was just saying having a permit, you know, like you have a permit to run the Middle Fork May 29th and, you know, having a permit in your hand, I think can cause problems.
All right, I'm using that one as an example when we get to consistency or commitment.
Yeah.
That's commitment all right there. A couple more. Overconfidence, underconfidence. We got just ego in general, trying to trying to prove something, unhealthy fear, unhealthy stress. And then this is my favorite one. Someone just said this at the last training I was at. And what do you suppose the highest, if there's one demographic, sorry, if there's one group demographic that increases the risk of a person getting trapped in an avalanche, not, I don't expect you to know it, but it's when the group is mixed. So if it's a co-ed group going out backcountry skiing, the rates of someone getting caught in an avalanche, I believe it's almost double.
And do they know why that is?
Therefore, well, make an assumption. Go ahead.
Let's make some assumptions today.
I'm curious.
I think the assumption that I think is somewhat safe is that people do things to impress other people quite often.
Like if you're with, you know, I think this is the thing. If you're skiing, you're with three dudes, you guys are like, ah, I don't know, that looks sketchy, let's turn around. If you're with some girl you're trying to impress, you're like, I'm gonna be the person to go out first and be rad and show that I'm the alpha. I think that's the assumption we're talking about.
I think so. And I
or paddling, you might portage something, but you were like, no, I'm gonna run this today because I want to impress this person. I've seen it happen firsthand a few times. So I know that. Like, wow, that person's really stepping up today. What's going on?
So would a camera be another one contributing factor?
I think so. Very much. The GoPro world, cameras on. Yeah. 100%. All right, let's do one more thing before we jump in. Personality types. There are, so as a counselor, I'm fairly familiar with this over the years, but there's one I learned that in context with Swiftwater Rescue instruction, and it's a very simple breakdown. I've mentioned most of these already, but and I don't know what you guys are coming from. Maybe pick your top two, one and two, but these are pretty self-explanatory. A thinker, talk about that. A feeler, and that's, and just to provide a quick definition of that, that's not so much you have feelings and like laugh all the time or cry all the time. It's more about your connection to others, or the why. They're the people that want to know why and the in the situation. So it's contextual. There are, number three is doers, and those are the people that just want to go. They don't like to scout for very long at all. And finally, there are observers, and they are very comfortable watching everybody else. They partner with a thinker quite a bit, but they want to see what's going on as much as possible before they commit to a choice.
Lee, I'm going to take us on a little tangent here. When I hear thinker and feeler, I think Myers-Briggs. Like, sure. You're either a thinker or a feeler, and that the doer observer is like almost a. It's hard to put those four together to me because I think of people as being either thinkers or feelers.
Right. And we know that even on that Myers-Briggs test, you know, it'll be 60-40. You tend to think more, but you have to feel to survive. You have to have context to life. You know, there again, like my example, I have to think if I'm going to survive boating, even though it's not my first instinct.
So I think, like, when I'm going to jump in. In Myers-Briggs, I'm an INTP. So I'm a thinker, but I'm certainly a doer. Like, I jump feet first into things all the time. So I would guess if I could choose two, it'd be both. But I couldn't pick one. Of those four, I'd have a hard time picking one.
Yeah.
I want to be a thinker because I want you to like me.
Nice. Well, if you're a thinker, then I want to be a feeler.
Damn it.
Eric, what do you think? What's your top two maybe?
Doer and probably like doer thinker is probably more. Probably my spaces. Feeler, not so much. An observer, not so much. So, yeah.
How about you, Jacob?
I'd say observer first and then thinker. If like we're at a rapid, I'll be a lot more comfortable if I've seen four or five people run it first. So that's how I landed on that conclusion.
Yeah, totally.
And me too. But as a doer, I'm going to be like, hey, can somebody run that for me, please? Like, I'm going to get the ball rolling. I'm like, I definitely want to see somebody do it, but I want to put somebody in motion, right, to get us through.
Yeah. So it's kind of like every river trip has got to have a thinker or someone who can access thinking. And every post-river trip, every party needs a feeler and a doer, right? Then you got the perfect combo of people to hang out with on a river trip. Someone to watch and laugh at the end, hopefully not during. All right, so that's my reference. If I end up talking about in a trap, who's susceptible, and I want to know what you guys think too. I'm, you know, anybody's susceptible, but I think there are personality types, and I'm going to be upfront and say, I think feelers and doers are more susceptible than other types in most traps. That's where I'm coming from on that. Trap. Awesome. When I was 20, I'm going to jump around a little bit. When I was 20 years old, I went to Maupin to be a guide. It was pretty hilarious. I think I convinced him that like I had taken a canoe down a flooded river in Iowa, so therefore I was qualified, which was true. But when I got there, I walked up. I'm not going to say the name on the show. People have to figure it out. But I walked up in close proximity to a beautiful 40-ish foot waterfall. And this waterfall, I found out relatively quickly it could be kayaked. And I didn't kayak back then. And I looked at that thing and was like, I'm going to kayak that someday. I don't know how, but that looks impossible. But if I heard it's been done, so I was like, I'm doing this. And this particular waterfall, for some strange reason, is closed for kayaking indefinitely. Like it's closed unless American Whitewater opens it up. So support them. But and it's a perfect, it's like, it's been described to me, and I've stood at the base and I've stood at the lip, and it's been described as the perfect 40-foot waterfall. Like if you can run a class 3, you probably could run this waterfall. Now that's a trap right there, by the way. But as I've gotten back into kayaking the last couple of years, what do you suppose has popped into my head? This lifelong goal thing, you know, I go back there once in a while, and one of the traps I feel like I'm very much at risk to fall into is this trap called scarcity of resource. And this is this idea that you will lose out on this chance to do something. And scarcity, it's where summit fever or powder fever comes from. You know, it's the only 30-inch day, whatever. But it also applies in whitewater with first ascents, with a dam going in or going out. You've traveled a long way. Someone said earlier you get a permit for the Middle Fork, and it's at 7 feet. And you go, oh, right. So these all apply in this. And my scarcity of resource has two things. One is this place is hardly ever open, where it's not covered in ice and you can access the river. So when it is, am I going to just drive there and go do it and really not be either mentally, physically prepared, have safety set up, things like that? But the other resource I got to deal with is my body, because I'm not going to be able to do this at a certain point in my life. It's not going to happen. And so I feel this kind of nagging, you know, but if I run this waterfall, I have to make a good choice. I have to gather all the evidence, data I can, and do it the right way. Otherwise, could easily fall into this scarcity of resource trap.
Well, I've got an example then that will kind of maybe help you achieve that goal, but also how to deal with heuristic traps. So that particular waterfall, I was with, there was a couple rafters who really wanted to run it. Now, as you can imagine, getting a raft somewhere that you're not allowed to raft is harder to do than getting a kayak, just because it's bigger, you got to pump it up. Being incognito is more difficult. So what we did is we looked around and went, is there another way to do this? Is there a way we can think outside the box and pull this off? And so what we came up with is we put in 4 miles upstream, floated down to it, portaged below the high water mark, and had somebody up at the camp with a radio to radio to us. And we were able to, the kayakers went first. Unfortunately, the rafter got hurt. So our plan went south, and the host had to get involved anyway. But we had thought outside the box, not fallen into the heuristic trap. Just an error was made. This was kind of during the time when rafters were determining how tall of a waterfall they could run. Nice. So naturally, there's going to be some consequence. But the idea there was, we thought, what's another way to do this? And portaging below the high water mark was the key. And it turns out when the sheriff did eventually come there, when we told him that was what we did, he said, well, that's fine. Like, they can't actually close the river. They can only close access to the river. So the plan worked. It just, part of it wasn't executed well at all.
Wouldn't there be some other heuristic traps fall into there. I think about that, like other rafts have dropped over 50-foot waterfalls. We can probably do the same and live.
At that time, I don't think it had been done that we were aware of.
Nobody had ever dropped over a waterfall that big?
Not that they were aware of. So in their mind, they didn't have any other information to go off of. I'm not saying somebody somewhere hadn't done it, but the information they had, it hadn't been done.
And then some sort of social proof here is a trap, like, hey, we want to be the first to drop over a waterfall. We want to push the limits. We want the photos. As the reason to try something like that, would that be a heuristic trap too?
Yeah, absolutely.
I could say, I could see them arguing against that, saying they were perfectly aware of the consequences and chose to take the risk anyway. But I can also, you're very much right that why take that risk? Why is that important to do?
Zach, to me, that it could be social proof. That one could be acceptance also of just you do something. And now I'm a judge of them, but I mean, as I get older, I definitely do things for me now. But when I was younger and growing, I was way more prone, and I still do, trust me. But I did things so that someone could see me do it. And that's a huge difference in our decision-making and cognitive process.
I mean, I know this waterfall you guys talk about. I've never paddled it because I have no interest in dropping 50 feet over a waterfall. But I think a lot of people, I mean, do they go there for themselves? Because you basically have to drive a few hours, get your car, hike your kayak in, see a launch in, and then walk out. Like, it's not paddling, it's just like, let's put all this effort in to go over a 50-foot drop. Is that for themselves, or is that a social proof thing? Is it like, let me get the Instagram photo?
Yeah, can I speak for myself on this one? I love
that's why I brought that up, because I'm really curious what you have to say about that.
Yeah, listen to this. I love putting up a rad photo, like, especially of me, why not, right? But man, on this one is so, this one's deeper. It's different for me. I would do it without a photographer. Absolutely. I would do that drop because it's just something I want to do for some reason. And that's all I can explain it. And maybe that's my evidence right there. But I've definitely done other drops. Yeah, that's, where it's like
that's
cameras on.
The question. Would you do it without the photo? That's the question I wonder sometimes.
Yeah, Zach, one, yeah. I think that's the question you're asking there, though, is like you framed it as, you know, do people do that? Where would people do that? And it's like, that doesn't really matter. What matters is, would you do it with or without the photo? And, you know, everybody has to make that decision for themselves. Like, some people would go out and run that falls. Like, I know what we're talking about. Some people would go through all that logistical sort of pain, but just to do that for themselves, even with nobody else there to watch them. And there's some people who they're only going to do it for the gram, you know? And I think the person who's doing it for the gram opens themselves up to all sorts of risk in ways that the other person doesn't because of the way they're going to make their choice and whether their no-go decision process is going to be different. But at the same time, like, I'm not going to sit here and try and adjudicate who's doing it for what. I can make that decision for myself, and that's basically it.
And I don't have a problem with somebody doing it for the gram. Like, I get it. I'm just trying to figure out, is that a heuristic trap? Doing it, you know, or is that the right reason? Like, you know, maybe doing it for Instagram is really for you. I have no idea.
It's a heuristic. It's a trap when it backfires on you, because the reality
is it backfire. Is it a huge win? Like, when you get hurt, it's a trap. When you slay it and your photo gets 10,000 likes, is it then not a trap and a massive win?
So that it's also how we progress as people too. If we don't ever do things to raise our own bar, and whatever fuels you to like to get better at something because someone else is watching, that's a lot of progress is made in all sports because of that. It's one upping. It's the next summit or the next route or the free solo. I mean, come on, dude. That's like that's the progression of a lot of things that happen. But yeah, that's acceptance. Acceptance is pretty black and white, in my opinion. And I don't always see it as a negative thing. I see it, you can get, you know, by wanting to be in a group to push yourself a little bit. But the key is this, right? The key is, am I giving myself a critical analysis of my skills and my ability and in my mind? And that's the key question in all these. It's you can go way into doing something to be accepted for it, but if you don't evaluate your skill set, that's where you're going to get in trouble. So it may not be if you get hurt or not, because you can get lucky, but it's a critical evaluation.
So Lee, you haven't paddled it yet?
No.
But you're going to?
We'll see. Okay. I'm gonna be okay if I don't, but
cool. You're evaluating your skill set right now.
Yeah. Let's jump to social proof. I'll use that same one. The first guy.
I want to interrupt really quick because I have a question that is a good transition to social proof. I don't know the difference between acceptance and social proof. They seem to be like the same thing.
Jacob, tell him.
Oh, I was just thinking in my head. I'm not sure either. Now, acceptance, is that like I accept the outcome, or acceptance like I want to be accepted by the people around me?
Yeah, it's doing something to gain acceptance into a group or a person. It's literally doing an action in hopes of them accepting you.
Social proof. How is social proof different than that?
I have a couple examples of social proof. Number one would be half slice boats. Okay. They are the craze right now. Who has one?
They're the best thing ever. I make my kayaking twice as fun.
Okay. If you watch a video with the pros on a half slice boat, they run anything in it, right? And it's so fun, and they're wheeling around and okay. So that means that someone who gets a half slice boat and goes, I want to progress like a pro and it's going to be a little harder, so I'm going to get a little bit better. They get into a situation where they're taking a boat that doesn't necessarily have a design that works very well in a boulder garden, for example. So, and let me give you an example. If you look at the bed of a river with all the boulders in it and you were to take a basketball and throw the basketball out, what happens to the basketball?
It would get stuck.
Bounces.
It would probably bounce. It's going to bounce and ricochet off of it. Likely. I mean, it could get stuck too, but
okay.
Way more odds the basketball is going to bounce. If you take a large pizza skillet plate thing, flat, you know, and you throw it up into rocks, what's going to happen?
Wedge in between them.
It's either going to wedge in between them, or it's going to pancake on them, and then the downforce of the river is going to paste the bottom of that boat to the river. And I've seen both. And I've, and in the short year that these have been popular, I've already been involved in more rescues than I can remember on pulling people off of and out of rocks in these boats. Hmm. And I'm not going to do one personally. I'm not going to tell anybody not to do one. But to me, that's a humongous social proof of the cool guys do it. And so it's okay to do it at my level and in the creeks around Oregon. So it's, and my other example is I boat with a guy named Brian, who's fantastic. I should never go after Brian, because Brian makes every rapid look so easy. And I put it in my mind, he did it, so why can't I do it? And I don't make it look easy. I usually make it look pretty bad after following him down something. So it's what we believe. If you see people in front of you style a rapid, but it goes back to skill, critical evaluation of your skill, do I have it or not? And you decide you think you have it because someone else did it, that's social proof. The other one I see on these videos where, again, like if you look at social proof from a professional kayaker level, those guys, if you watch Ascender's video, what are they doing? They're running crazy stuff and they're jumping up and down, partying, yelling. And at least when I boat, if I run anything hard, I don't feel that way at all. I feel the opposite way. I want to just survive. And I kind of enjoy that feeling, but I'm not like throwing shakas and jumping up and down. And like, this is so amazing that we almost died. Like but the social proof of that kind of says that's maybe how that's supposed to be if you're a really good boater.
Is social proof something that exists because of social media then? Like before social media, this wasn't a thing.
Still a thing. In a more personalized individual experience, like parts of your group. But the fact that you can now watch, you know, somebody do it on YouTube, you go into it with that sort of trap already there before you've even left your door in a way that maybe didn't show up until you actually got there before, if that makes sense.
Did the like LVM and Twitch videos have that impact? I think that was just before I started kayaking, but
Bridge Creek is a great example. Like there was a bunch of video of Bridge Creek in that. And in my boating level at that time, like I never should have been thinking about Bridge Creek. And I was like scheming up how do we get to Bridge Creek? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's the risk with some of those is that, you know, videos make things look smaller than they are and less steep than they are and less consequential than they are. And these guys go down in style at making it look easier than it is. Yeah, I think I think those videos definitely did that.
But would you, so you'd make the argument that the social media before social media were like videos, were like VHS tapes.
Well, I would, it's always been live as well, because what social proof is it's a false sense of security based on who you're with. You're not evaluating your own skill anymore. My first real day of kayaking was in the Blue River outside of Eugene's beautiful little, you know, kind of 3.5 mile runs. Awesome. It's like mostly class three. And I was just barely good enough to run it, right? I went upside down a couple times, but I was in a group that I knew all these people were local boaters, and they were good. They were safe boaters. And my confidence went up because I had these people with me that knew the run. Now, again, yin and yang, right? It's not always a bad thing. I had to get on that river at some point. It's better to get on it with someone who's competent and knows their own rescue skill. But I still, I had kind of an inflated sense of my own ability. And I felt that a few times on that run where I felt safer in this group. Now I could have easily gone in and pitoned on something and really screwed up because the skill wasn't there to do it.
Here's another one. And I'm not sure exactly how it fits in, but I think it does. I've got a buddy who grew up in, or started boating in that KO time period, and they ran everything in playboats. So his first time down the Little White playboat, upper Cispus playboat, he didn't even have a creek boat, so it never crossed his mind, and that's what everyone else was doing, so that's what he did.
I remember those days. First time I ran Mill Creek was in a creek boat. The middle fork of the Rogue was a creek boat, like Tacoma Gorge section creek, but oh yeah, I remember those days. When I go back, I ran one of those like a year ago, and I was in a creek boat, and I was like, holy shit, how am I alive? Like, that's amazing. I can't believe we did that. I would never consider doing that again.
Way more people ran playboats down hard stuff back then. That was common right now. So a half slice, it's like, I know people have done this stuff in Ultrafuge. So a half slice, at least there's volume in the front. But I guess that's a heuristic trap too.
Could be, for sure. I had that one. I had the same. I thought you guys might bring that up. I haven't kayaked long enough. You know, what happened is, my understanding is someone was running a slice boat back then, and at least one really good kayaker, maybe two, died. And then everybody went, this isn't a good idea to be in this style of boat running that hard of water.
I don't know about that. I'm not sure what happened. I think just like kayaking changed. Maybe.
Well, I think, and playboats got shorter. Back in those days, we were running like Mr. Gleans, you know, those were damn near 8 feet long. And just really slicey on both ends. Like, I think that changed a ton when like a G-Force came out, and now your playboats were 6'4" and, you know, like basically super slow. Like that. My memory is there was a major change in that period. And that was sort of some time like Twitch videos came out, and Piranha boat, the whatever the heck it was, like
in his own
Teo was paddling a bunch. Yeah, all those. Like there was sort of for a while it was kind of like there was little differences between the style of boats you would use, and then all of a sudden there was big differences between the style of boats you would use. And they sort of evolved in different directions from that. It was like sort of a divergence. You know, around the time of the X and Mr. Clean and like those boats.
Because people would run stuff like that down, moderately hard stuff. But then I think that time of Teo, things just blew up. It was all of a sudden people were running 30, 40, 50 footers all the time, which you could do in a playboat, but then it just became like, because kayaking progressed so much, you couldn't do the really, really hard stuff in a playboat. So your primary boat
worthy stuff.
Yeah, your primary boat became a creek boat, so you could go get rad. I don't know. Who knows? We're way off the topic now.
We are.
It's good stuff. Familiarity. I don't know where we are in Safe Sack, but
we've done everything but E. I'm taking notes here.
Oh, right on. Well, we haven't done familiarity yet. I don't think.
Okay. You haven't done that.
That one, I don't know why. This one for me, I feel like I've probably because I boat local runs. I don't always travel that far to kayak, so I run a lot of the same runs, which I like. Familiarity is a trap because you get so comfortable on the same run that you might not do things that you should do on every single run. For example, bring a throw bag on every single run, but you might run it because you say, I ran this every time, right? Same with rafting, you know, you might, you know, like, we have an awesome run outside of Eugene called the Miracle Mile, and you can't really see down any rapids. I think the gradient's like, it's over 200 feet. But you don't stop to scout. And you know, one of the rules in boating, right, is don't run something you can't scout. But on that one, it just gets run so much in the spring and people talk. But at really any given moment, a tree can move or fall down or rock can move. And so that's, so you kind of break your own rule sometimes with this heuristic trap. So it's pretty simple, but I'll just jump in real quick. So I'm probably getting low on time, but what I do see on when people get really familiar with runs, and this might, again, might bring up some examples, but I see people, they don't scout for sure. They boat solo way more often, but I guess if there's a place you're going to do that, that would be the place, right? Launch super late in the day. I definitely see more drinking and boating on local runs, right? Cause you're super comfy. I think doers are the personality type that gets this one. I got to get one more lap in. I got to feel it. I got to get the burn. Maybe what's the most familiar run you guys have ever had in your boating career? What's the run that's yours?
For me right now, it's the Lower Hood. It's a class 3 run, a backyard.
I guess the Clackamas, just cause I guided there in the summer.
Yeah, I feel like I can't. The places that I have guided would be those places, right? I mean, Zach, like the Lower Rogue, which isn't really the same style of trip, but as far as like the piece of river where it's like know every rock, you know, there's the places you guide.
The Tuolumne River is like that for me. Like I spent a lot of time guiding there, so I know. Like if I went back now, I would be like, oh, that rock moved, that rock moved, that rock moved, and I haven't been there 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. For a while, I think my sort of backyard run was the Truss back when I lived in Portland. Like that was it's like when there wasn't water anywhere else, we'd just go do that to the point where it was like, oh, we're doing this again. funny. Then you get on and be like, this is amazing. Every time it happened, every time. But I haven't boated there in years and years now. I probably wouldn't even remember.
Oh, so this wasn't my first time down the Truss. We ran it, got done. I went up and did the shuttle. It was just like a year ago, 2 years ago. And I remember it was summer, but it was like eight o'clock. And a car pulls up and a guy jumps out in his kayak and just takes off down the trail solo. And I like my jaw dropped. I was like, what? Like I was probably freaked out after my first time down. And like, here's a guy so comfortable. Well, you know, probably one of the pros, you know, just punching a lap right before dark. It's like,
probably drinking beer in the drive up to put in.
Wow.
It's quite a lot to go in that parking lot. At BZ, I see a lot of stuff like that happen.
Yeah. It
happens pretty commonly. We'll get a dusk lap in with a beer in their hand, getting ready to drive up.
Yeah. Yeah. But I guess you could say it's back to having a realistic analysis of your skill, a critical evaluation of your skill. Cause I can't do that. There's, you know, that's something I don't plan to do.
I think that's hard. How can somebody evaluate their own skill?
Well, yeah. So I think we'll come back to that one.
I think it's likes. I would add to that. Likes on Facebook.
Yeah. That familiarity one, I think and maybe this fits in somewhere else, but you know, I could be super familiar with something. And this happened to me once when I could be super familiar with something, but my skill set could change. Right. Like, I know this section of river really, really well. I boated it 1,000 times, but the last time of that 1,000 was 24 months ago, and I haven't been in my kayak since then. So like I still intellectually very much know the run, but my boating skill set is not where it was the last 950 times that I've done that run. And that can make a big difference. You know, I think the last time I boated Canyon Creek was like that way. I hadn't boated like a year and a half or 2 years, and a run that I would have done like to put on at 7 o'clock at dusk, you know, kind of a thing, which I did do. I went back and felt like I was going to get my ass handed to me like half the run, because my skill set was totally different than the last time I had done it.
I'm hypersensitive to that one too. We used to paddle Cherry Creek all the time. There'd always be the somebody coming back who hadn't paddled in 10 years, and they would always get hammered without doubt. And I remember saying, I never want to be that person.
Good examples. Expert Halo, Zach, what do you got?
There we go. Expert Halo. Oh, do you want me to give you an example?
What do you think? Should we describe it quick?
If people view you as an expert, first of all, I want to say, if you ask me the definition of heuristic trap any day of the week, I'd mess it up. I'm so bad at understanding this. I get the concepts, but thank you for sharing this with us, because I am, no matter how many times people explain this to me, I can't explain it back to anybody. So with that said, my best guess for Expert Halo is if somebody around you is an expert, you feel like you're taken care of and you might take bigger risks.
Exactly. It's it's not questioning, back to the critical analysis. Yeah. It's not stopping to evaluate really what's happening. It's blind faith. It's putting your trust in someone who may or may not be worthy of that trust. So, you know, in the guide world, most companies, most places, I'm sure, you know, this is what people pay for, right? This is the experience they want. They don't really want to have to think about. And if anything, the guide kind of says, this is crazy. Wow, you're really at high risk, but they know they're not, right? But in private trips, I think this becomes much more of a potentially a trap where someone, maybe they're the oldest, they've been boating the longest, they kind of take over and they don't have everyone's best interest in mind. And let's hear what you got.
Is this the one, like, would this also be, or I have understood this in the past, and maybe this is actually a different one, to be if you had like four people, like a group of four, and they're all really good, like, you know, they would all sort of fall into that expert, you know, really knowledgeable level, and none of them wants to be the naysayer in that group. Mm. Like, you know, you read about this in the avalanche world. There was that big avalanche in Baker a bunch of years ago, and they talked about this being one of the main causes. It was a bunch of pros, and none of them, you know, all sort of pros, nobody wanted to be the naysayer. You know, the person that said this isn't a good idea. Would that fall into the expert one, or is that a different, that's probably a different level?
I think it's really close to that. It's the same ideas, because when we talk about expert Halo, we're not talking about like me or you as the expert. It's being in a group where an expert wants to take over and either can't do it or won't do it. And like you said, Eric, it's not saying, hold on a minute, we need to evaluate this before we take another step forward. The expert takes it and goes. And when they have the most experience, the problem is it's hard to do that. But the other big problem is that someone who takes over from the expert level or a trip leader type level is now dismissing any other idea that could be a good idea. And they're only using their expertise. If you're in a group of 10 people, I guarantee you somebody knows something that could help out in a rescue that could be utilized. So it's that mentality that it's my way. Please, you know, do as I say, and no one stops to interrupt. So the interrupting part's right on, I think.
I'm gonna interrupt you right now. Does this depend on a bad leader then? Like, this exists when there's somebody who's a bad leader, or can this exist when there's a good leader as well? Like, what I'm hearing is there's a leader who basically is saying, I'm the badass, follow me. But could also be that nobody questions that person because they all have so much faith in them.
Yes.
Could you be a great leader and still have people fall into the expert Halo? Like, somebody who actually genuinely wants feedback from people and wants to take their time, but if people are afraid to ask you, would that be the same thing?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like, good and bad is a little bit, you got it to it at the end. It's, are they equipped to lead? Do they have the skill set to lead? Are they making decisions with everyone's ability and interest in mind? So I would say bad if they can't do that.
I've got an example of how I messed that up not too long ago. So we were going on a trip on a creek that I was familiar with, but only a couple other people in the group were, and it was a large group. And one of the people had very little creeking experience, but they were very good at kayaking. They were running big water, class five, running stuff I would not even consider running. So we had a pretty good day, and we got down to one of the very last rapids. And the error I made was that I viewed this rapid as very easy. I would consider it a class three move, very fun. And so what I thought I'd do is it'd been kind of a long day, and I'd reward the group by sending them all over blind, because that's fun to do. And I had done it before, and everybody had had a great time. And so I said, all right.
You've done it before at the same rapid.
I had done that at the same rapid, yeah, with a different group of people.
Got it.
And we had even scouted this rapid on the way in. It was a hike and run, and so you got to see it as you crossed over a bridge. And so I said, all right, follow the ducks or something. So we got in a row like a ducks, and we all went, and there's probably eight people or something. And first seven people just slide down, launch off the bottom, big smiles on their face, whooping and cheering. I had eddied out to just make sure everybody was okay. And the last person, who was this accomplished big water boater, had just been, for some reason, gone 4 feet to the right of everybody else, landed, like, so it was no longer a clean slide. It was now like a 10-foot boof onto a rock shelf, like really hurt their back, and then got shoved into an undercut and just stuck there for 5 or 10 seconds. And it was pretty scary. And so the error I made was that I assumed this person would see the situation in a certain way, and I didn't take into account that something they had already told me, which was they have no creaking experience. So what I should have done there. And then when I told them to just go ahead and do the ducky in a row, they had just trusted me because I was the expert in that situation. So that was a big learning experience for me to really think about that. And I don't know what the exact conclusion is, but I've given it plenty of thought. But I think that's an example of expert halo.
Jacob, when you say you don't know the exact conclusion, I think about this a lot when we talk about heuristics. And I think we're done going over the safe sack according to my thing. So I'm gonna use that example to bring up kind of my thinking about heuristics. I don't feel like we can just read safe sack and just be safer. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like this is my, maybe, and I guess I want feedback on this. Like, if I read a book about heuristic traps, I don't think that's going to keep me from falling into them. Right. Or if I get a presentation on heuristic traps, like, oh, these are things you should be careful of them. I don't know how that helps me improve. I think what helps is the stories like yours, Jacob, right? Like, I feel like using safe sack to share examples and stories to give, I think that's where the learning can happen with heuristics. Does that make sense? Like, I've always had an issue when I see a presentation of heuristics, and maybe that's why I've never been able to learn them, because I just don't, it doesn't seem practical to me to read them and go, oh, cool, I'll avoid these things. So I don't know. I want to hear what you guys think. Or do you guys learn differently than I do?
I like examples.
Yeah.
But I think there's two different things. I think you're talking about two different things. Like, you're talking about learning sort of what heuristics are and, you know, how you define them, and stories that give you context for understanding what that means. I think the second piece, though, is a practice that you have to instigate, like, in your doing of things, where every time you get to a major decision junction, because you learn these things, you now build into your practice of, okay, I'm going to go through SafeSack real quick and just make, or try to understand how my decision making is being influenced, or why am I going to make the choice I'm going to do.
You would be about a rapid and be like, oh, let me go through SafeSack really quick to make sure I'm not falling into a trap.
Like, do I do that all the time? No.
Have you ever
found that in boating world, I have started to more. In the avalanche world, like, that was such a big thing a couple of years ago that I definitely found myself, like, especially after having a couple pretty close calls in situations that understanding why I'm making choices would have not put me in situations that were really scary. I have found myself being much more aware of why I'm making certain choices. How am I, how's my body right now? Am I regulated, dysregulated? The group that I am with, how is that influencing the choice I'm going to make, whether I'm choosing to ski this or skin up there or like do those kinds of things. Like I'm being more conscious of the background behind the decision that I'm making because I've started to hopefully instill a practice where that becomes regular. And through doing it there, I found myself doing it more in boating too. Like, do I really want to put on at this water level? Why am I going to run this rapid? What is the influence here versus, you know, am I doing, am I making this choice purely based on understanding my skill set, or am I making this choice because I want to look rad in front of these dudes or be accepted by them socially or not be an old person or like, you know, all of those things. So I think there's a practice piece. You have to learn the basics and then you have to instill a practice in your behavior.
And this plays out differently on every trip. It plays out differently when your guides work, Zach, than it does a private party going down the Middle Fork, than it does some rafters going down class three, than it does a group of kayakers running class four or five. They're all really different, and including the skill set of each group. One way, Zach, you'll like this, I think. A couple years ago, I started, if I was a trip leader, quote unquote, like going to Idaho, I started assigning roles based on what I would email people. I know most of the people I boat with, so it's not like I need to give them a questionnaire, but I would say like, you're a safe person. You want to be safety manager on the trip, you know? And when we do our pre-trip meeting together, you know, so-and-so safety manager, what they say is law. They use the word safe in a sentence. Everybody has to stop, get her back. Got a deal? Yeah. I have people that are good in kayaks. Will you be downriver safety if something really goes wrong? Someone who's the ducky person or whatever. I have someone who I want as an incident commander. I want a thinker in that job. I don't want someone who's going to freak out, right? I want an engineer or something. So we agree on roles. And we have a set, like for incident commander, we have a sub role. And this includes people we come up upon on the river so that we literally can launch into helping out a group without going, what do I do? Like if I know I'm the go. I'll be the person who's going to put the tether on and go after somebody on live bait. So I know the things I'm good at. I know things I shouldn't be doing. One's probably an incident commander. So we assign those before a trip. So that's kind of where like my brain thinks about it that way a little bit, where I'm avoiding traps right there. Like I had a safety manager who's going to call spat if they drink too much and go pocket padding or whatever. And
so. So the safety manager is different than the incident commander.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and there's like a trip leader. There's the trip. I have a guy that I run trips with who likes to get up early. He likes to make coffee. He likes to get people going in the morning. He's not afraid to go, okay, let's go. It's time to go. I don't want to be that person. So he's our trip manager.
An incident commander and a safety person. And they're all different people.
Yes, absolutely. And I want everyone to have a job. So they're all have importance in my trips.
This is on a multi-day trip. Yes, what about a day trip? What if we go kayaking tomorrow, the four of us? Are you going to be like, hey, Zach, you're nothing, but Eric, you're safety commander, Jacob, you're incident commander, and I'm trip leader.
Well, I actually went boating with Lee recently, and we didn't have a safety commander, but he did say, you're probably going to be in front because you know the run best. I'll be in the back doing sweep most of the day. So he did have that initiative. And
but do you, where do you draw the line between like, one day, half day kayaking trip and 6 day Maine salmon trip. When do you implement that plan?
Depends who's on the trip. You know, like if there was anybody on the trip that Jacob and I just did, I wasn't sure. I knew the boaters probably a little better than he did. But if there was someone I was like, this guy's new, we got to watch out, or the girl's new, we got to watch out for him. Then we would talk about that. Let's put this person in third position, you know, whatever. And I started, when we do kayak trips bigger than like four, like someone, I think someone should be designated as sweep. Same with rafting, because we were on a trip with 11 people the other day. We had no idea if everybody was through a rapid or not. So just some general rules.
Other topic, right? Like I'll regularly go do the lower hood and four of us will go and see five friends at put in and three more friends a mile down. And all of a sudden there's 12 boats on the river in different groups than we started with. Right? Like, is that okay? But this is a whole separate topic. Like, should we be running in our pods? How should we organize? Like that's a whole other thing that's culturally worth talking about.
Zach, I think one thing I would add too is kind of what Lee and Jake were talking about. You know, maybe it's my doer nature, but I like to think about how do we practice these things, like, so we can know them, but they should change the way we behave. And I think a lot about, I've done this in my boating for sure, and also in like backcountry travel with groups that maybe, ideally with all groups, but certainly with groups that maybe have less experienced people, is even like intergroup communication. So making it a norm that before we make a choice to do something or, you know, run a rapid or ski something, like each individual person, you go to each individual person, how are you about this? What are your thoughts? You know, like trying to reduce the opportunity where some of these heuristic traps of like expert, you know, the expert halo and some of those kinds of things, like you can sort of, through intentional practices and ways you set your group dynamics up, you can try to put in places to undo the tendencies we can fall into.
Exactly. Really, yeah. Well said. And that has to start with knowing who you are as a person. And hopefully, like, if you're have what somewhat of a role where you're in charge and leading, knowing who your group is too, knowing what their tendencies are.
I'm going to play devil's advocate really quick. I just want to express some things I've been having. Yeah. Standard. I jump in. I feel like when I go boating with five or six people, that I typically do these things you guys are talking about, but after a while I get kind of tired of it. Like all of a sudden I'm the one also organizing the shuttle. Like sometimes I just want to go paddling. I want to surf. I want to have a good time. I don't want to be like trip leader every time. And so I find myself, especially this fall, in that role. Like I have to get, we're meeting at this time, we're jumping in this car and on the river, I need you guys to do this, 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 and this. And next thing you know, every time I paddle with these groups, I'm trip leader. And I kind of was like, at some point, I just want to show up, jump in a car, and have fun.
Solo boat.
I think that's a struggle I have, is always being pigeonholed in that position. When I don't, sometimes I don't mind it, but I don't want to always be in that position.
This is not an answer to your question, but I hear you. But let's say hypothetically, Jacob and I were on a trip, and hypothetically it was December and someone showed up without a dry suit, and hypothetically they started putting on fleece and a rain jacket with a strap connected to their to their spray skirt.
Hypothetically, there's a picture of it, and yeah.
Hypothetically, they were in a half slice boat, yeah, and hypothetically they pinned in a class five. So you know, here we are. Like, it was so funny. I'll just, maybe we finish the whole thing with this. I said to Jacob, "Hey, you gonna come on the show Wednesday?" And someone goes, "What's a heuristic trap?" Jacob goes, "Kind of like right now." And I think I tell that story, you know, with like, with one will lead to another every damn time. Like one will, you get one, another's right. It's knocking on the door to happen. And so of all the people, you know, to get pinned on this trip, needing a rescue, and then now risking being in a 38 degree river, not even halfway through the run, you know, should I have said no? I have my, you know, I have my reasons why I might not. And definitely in certain situations, there are some rivers I'm not getting on. This one had a road nearby. Figured, I know the ability of the person. So I don't know. Jacob, what do you think about that? You probably thought about it a little bit.
Yeah, I did think about it. First off, I think of those as learning opportunities, and it seemed like a pretty safe place to learn something. The guy seemed very comfortable doing it. And I kind of sometimes go, huh, this could be a learning opportunity for me as well as other people. So I knew there was an escape route to the road. The guy seemed just fine mentally for the task. And I'd actually done that before, so I knew it was possible to use a rain jacket and duct tape the neck and wrists, and that the person will be cold, but they'll make it down a 3-4 mile run if everything goes well. And if not, I knew both of those runs you could hike out of, which would keep that person warm while they're hiking. So I thought I I was kind of sitting like this when I saw him putting that on in my mind.
Did he forget his stuff, or that's just how he rolls?
No, he forgot.
He forgot. Yeah. And it's worth noting he was fine. Like, he was stern squirting the whole day and got to the end and was not dangerous.
Yep.
I've done the same thing. An example of, I think this is the scarcity trap, where I wanted to paddle the Elk River really bad. It's on the Oregon coast. It hardly runs. It's far from everything. We left Grants Pass and we got to Brookings and realized one of us forgot everything behind. And so we called a friend of ours who lived there and got like stuff that, like a wetsuit and stuff that was too small of everything. And like, we shared, like, one of us wore the good dry suit, one of us wore the wetsuit, one of us wore the good helmet, one of us wore the bad helmet. We both had terrible stuff. But because we had already driven 2 hours and it was so rare to run this section, I really wanted to do it, we powered through. But it could have got us into trouble. But because it didn't, that's a win, right? If it had gone bad, it would be a heuristic trap. But because it didn't, we're heroes. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. I love doing rescues when it's a heads-up rescue. I'm okay with that all day. But yeah, when it's not, it's not.
And Zach normally does this, but this is the devil's advocate to what we've been saying. And that has a little bit to do with what I mentioned at the beginning, where kayaking doesn't have these laws. And some of the beauty of kayaking is just sort of pushing those, because you find out, oh, I had these perceptions of what the limits were, and that wasn't right. And what my perception of the limits and what was safe when I was 19, I've actually realized, wow, a lot of those things that I thought you had to do were kind of, you can go way past those limits. And my